Welcome to The Rink. I'm James Tapelake Graylian. Ready to finish his checks is Tom Luongo from NHL Fanhouse. If an official was abused and nobody videotaped it, did it really happen? We're going to answer that. Plus, we have our cup upside down cake, and we ate it too. And John Press of Japers Rink was kind enough to talk to us right after the Capitals Canucks game. Spoiler alert, Caps won. That's coming up next on The Rink. It must have seemed like a no-brainer to the NHL. Hire Stadium Rock Band to play opening day of Hockey in America. Unfortunately, everything turned pretty ugly when Joe Elliott of Def Leppard turned the Stanley Cup upside down when he set it on a table. They didn't realize that they needed an instruction manual for the thing.
Obviously, I didn't know that soccer guys were illiterate because there's all those names on the side of the Stanley Cup, and they were all upside down.
He held the thing over his head and then set it on a table upside down. And these are the people that the NHL hired to play Face Off Rocks. Now, the Zambonis, the ultimate hockey rock band, was in New York at the NHL store, powered by Reebok. Right? There's a slightly embarrassing name for you, but here's. Yeah, you know, they're playing in New York, and that's fine. They're busy, but you couldn't find some band that knows hockey and isn't going to make excuses.
Couldn't have gotten Bare Naked Ladies, Rush, Five for Fighting, any Canadian. Just get a Canadian band and have them come in and do it right. I mean, what's
Our Lady Peace? They cut away to probably the worst looking Alanis Morissette video I've ever seen in my entire life. Whoever was doing that video should be reprimanded seriously. It was horrible. But Def Leppard, you think it's a lock, and then no.
Every time I think about how the NHL markets themselves for any length of time at all, I start to get really embarrassed. And it's funny. I was watching the opening game of the Caps season Saturday night, and during the player introductions, I'm listening to this god-awful thrash metal stuff that they were playing in the arena, and you could tell the players were just like, oh, God, stop, make it go away. And I'm like, why do they think this is what we want? You know, I almost prefer just the old cheesy organ music and stuff, and I don't get it, and I don't understand why they think they have to put on these shows and these light shows and stuff, and it's all really just very boring, because it's not spectacle. It's all just forced. It's not spontaneous. It's not fun. It's the antithesis of fun, actually.
Is there anybody in NHL arenas at the games other than the 20 people dancing to it and the 50 kids who don't know better who actually like Cotton Eye Joe? Is there anybody?
Right, exactly.
It's that constant battle that the NHL has with themselves of their heydays and their going retro and trying to be absolutely modern, and they constantly try and skirt that line and seem to fail over and over and over.
Yeah, it's just bad. Now, conversely, you know, the new marketing campaign on the NHL Network is good. I love the advertisement with Braden Coburn, where he's going through all the injuries he's had. Well, I broke my nose a couple times. That didn't stop me.
You're letting the players sell the game.
Yeah, they're letting the players sell the game. I'm like, Braden Coburn, good job. Why are you playing in Philly? You're kind of cool. And, I lost four teeth, and that didn't stop me.
Well, then they have that other.
They said they were going to have to, like, puncture a lung and reflate it. But, you know, next time that, you know, I asked the doctor next time, you know, if you're going to keep me out, make it something serious. I'm like, dude, nice. Very cool.
And then they also have that other really bad one where is this the year?
Aren't any.
Or how about with the photographs telling us how the player failed last year? Those are just depressing. They're kind of creepy.
They are kind of creepy, but they're actually oddly interesting. I actually felt really bad for Sidney Crosby. He did a really good job.
Is that the first time and only time you will ever feel bad for Sidney Crosby?
No, come on, man. He just said, I really don't want to be in this photograph again. I'm like, you know, that's kind of heartbreaking, actually. That's kind of cool.
The Henrik Lundqvist one kind of reminds me of a David Lynch movie.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Like Lost Highway, it's like Lost Goalie in a way. You know? I expect Patricia Arquette to show up and, well it was, never mind. That's another. Yeah, that'll be on another channel.
Yeah. oh, man.
You're right. It is great. Better. Those are great. The player's selling the game, you know. They're talking about the game, and it makes you actually want to kind of get interested in the player, you know. All right, so tell me about Buffalo and the shootout.
Oh, that was a good game, actually. That was probably the best game I've watched all year so far, though I thought the...
How many games have you seen all year so far?
About six, actually. I've watched about six so far. I watched a little bit of Phoenix and Anaheim tonight before we did this, so this will be Sunday night where we're recording this, nay, Sunday morning. But the Buffalo-Montreal game was really well played. I was very, very pleased as a Buffalo fan. This was the kind of game that they lost multiple times last year. They couldn't win the 2-1 game, and they lost like seven of their first seven shootouts last year as well. So to see them outshoot and outchance Montreal, except for about the last 5 minutes in the overtime where Montreal really, really pushed and Miller stood his ground, which was nice to see. They outshot and outchanced Montreal, and they didn't give the game away. And then they went in and you know, scored two quick ones in the shootout and got it done. And it just – this was the kind of thing that they needed to do to exercise some of the lingering doubts from last season, where they couldn't put those games away, where they weren't giving up – you know, they still haven't given up a 3-goal lead yet, so we'll see. But it's the first step in the right direction that, you know – maybe they've got their legs under them, or their, at least their heads in the right place, because their heads were certainly not in the right place when they opened the season last year, giving up seven goals to the Islanders. Still shudder at the concept of giving up seven goals to the Islanders. So, no, it was a good game. And I watched a bunch of Detroit and Ottawa Saturday night. That was a fine game as well. Interesting to note that Detroit, when they needed to, just, you know, they just took it up to another level that Ottawa couldn't match in the third period, and broke Gerber down for two goals and then walked out. And is anybody shocked that the first night that Danny Heatley was the captain in Ottawa that he was a minus one? I wasn't. Detroit's going to be tough. I mean, even though they went ahead and they had that pretty crappy opening night against the Maple Leafs, and you know, like everything else in Toronto, life moves pretty quick.
It does move pretty fast in Toronto because the mighty Leafs of Toronto lose to the Canadians 6-1. Turn around and basically become themselves again.
Exactly. They go from Stanley Cup contenders to battling the Islanders in the Tavares lottery all in, 24 hours?
Yeah.
So, or 48 hours. So... there's Montreal is going to be tough all year long, but it was a very, like, the game between Montreal and Buffalo was very technical. Both teams' defense were just very solid. I checked the shot tracker on ESPN after the game, and I noted that the Sabres only gave the Canadiens six shots from the in the box between the crease and the faceoff dots. And Thomas Vanek had eight shots from that same area himself. So they were obviously doing what they needed to do, and they got rewarded for it. So it was a good, good game.
And this week on The Rink, as opposed to me, we're going to have James give you his 2 minutes or so on what he thinks about the incident involving Mike Pekka and referee Greg Kimmerle this past weekend.
This past weekend, Michael Pekka of the Columbus Blue Jackets was suspended, quote-unquote, indefinitely from the National Hockey League for violating rule number 41 of the rulebook, physical abuse of an official. Now, indefinite at this point means exactly what it sounds like, lacking definition. It could be one game, it could be 10 games, it could be 100 games. Nobody knows at this point. It's under review, as it should be. Part of the problem with the rule is that the rule comes with an automatic suspension for the player, which is not the position that an on-ice official should be put in. The on-ice official's job is to call the game at hand, not to decide what a player's career should be like whether it's that game, 10 games from then, or whenever. That is the job of the league. That sort of power should be taken away from the referees because it's just as much of a hindrance as anything else. Now, Michael Pekka himself says that he grabbed the official by the arm to slow him down and had some pretty choice words. And words happen. Things are said in hockey games, tempers flare. That happens all the time. We see it over and over on our broadcasts. But really, Michael Pekka should know better. Don't grab an official by the arm. Now, most likely, Michael Pekka has not read the rule book. Most players haven't read the rule book. Coaches haven't read the rule book. Chances are the broadcasters who tell you night after night that there was a bad penalty called or a penalty was missed haven't read the rule book. And chances are you, the fan, haven't read the rule book either. Now, I've read the NHL rule book. I've studied the USA Hockey rule book. I've read the case books. And I've attended a refereeing seminar. And I'm still not qualified to tell you whether or not most of the calls in the NHL are good calls or bad calls. Ron McLean of Hockey Night in Canada changed his tune about refereeing after he actually refereed a preseason game himself. And he's a level 5 referee with Canadian Amateur Hockey Association. It's a difficult job, and if you don't believe so, think about the referee who has to call a game in Dallas. You have players skating around at 30 miles an hour, and 60 feet away from you, a black stick is lifted towards a guy wearing black pants and a black jersey. There are a few other guys skating between the referee and the players, and the referee will still get the call right most of the time. From the lowest levels of amateur hockey, referees are booed by fans, screamed at by hockey moms, bitched at by coaches, and treated horribly by players. In the NHL, these players complain about every call from the little ticky-tack offsides to the most obvious holding calls. The referees are overworked, they're underpaid, and still they get the call right most of the time. It's one of the worst jobs in hockey. And these guys are going to do it again tomorrow because they love the game as much, if not more, than you or I.
Well, after the nation got to see the Washington Capitals beat up the Vancouver Canucks 5-1, we talked with John Press, who runs Japer's Rink, a Capitals blog, and writes for NHL Fan House, about the Caps.
I have a copy of ESPN the magazine here with Alexander Ovechkin on the cover.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, was Sidney Crosby not available that day?
I don't know. It's impressive the press that Ovechkin has gotten, considering kind of the odds that were stacked against him coming into the league. But you know, I guess last year the numbers he put up and the things he did just couldn't be denied. And I think that more and more you're seeing people embracing his personality and realizing that he might not fit the stereotypes they had for European players, Russian players, and that kind of thing. You know, he does it all on the ice, and his personality off the ice is pretty special as well.
One of the complaints I've always had about Ovechkin, which was answered tonight after the 5-1 win of the Caps over the Vancouver Canucks, was kind of his defensive play. And that sometimes he seemed like he was cherry picking or lollygagging on the defensive side and stuff like that. Tonight he's on the penalty kill.
Yeah, well, that's something that Boudreaux is trying a bit this year, changing things up. He's put Alex Semin out there on the penalty kill too, and Alex Semin is certainly not what you think of as a defensively responsible guy. But you know, I think that he likes to get guys up top on the penalty kill who move their feet and who can put a little pressure on the opposing D and, you know, get a break here or there. Alex Ovechkin had two shorthanded goals in the preseason, and that was certainly encouraging. But by the same token, Ovechkin was out there on the penalty kill that they gave up a goal on tonight and on the Ron Hainsey goal in the, Friday night's game. And on both those, I think he missed an assignment and didn't get back on his guy. But, you know, he takes a lot of grief for his defensive play, but here's a guy who was plus 28 last season in Ovechkin. And, you know, two seasons ago, the Caps had a bad team, and he was minus 19. And I guess that fed right into what people, you know, the narrative that people wanted to discuss about him, and you know, he turned it around last year. I mean, he was almost plus 50 better in the span of one season. That's impressive.
Quite something. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's interesting. JP, that I've noticed this trend this year. I've seen at least four different teams now trying to use their young superstars, whatever the best, I guess Crosby, Ovechkin, Vanek, and Spezza would all be considered superstars in today's league, and they're all killing penalties. So I think it's a move in the league to try and spread their ice time around a little bit and not have to play them as much 5-on-5. They're the best players. They're the ones with the most skill. They should kill penalties, and or at least that's the way that the coaches are looking at it. If they want to be the dominant players, then they really have to lead the team in all areas of the ice. And something that Ruff just quoted, so something about Vanek, he said that just recently, he wants him to be the best two-way player in the game. And, you know, I don't know if he's ever going to get there, of course, but it just seems like that's a trend. We've got Malkin killing penalties over in Pittsburgh. You've got Spezza and even Heatley killing penalties over in Ottawa now. So sure. I've seen.
Well, I think that, you know, some of the guys that everybody would want a Pavel Datsyuk and a Henrik Zetterberg on their team, and those guys are kind of the model, I think, in some ways there. But especially early in the season when the refs are just so in tune to calling every ticky-tack penalty, if you're not using these guys in the penalty kill, sometimes you look up at the end of the game and they're, you know, each side's had 8 power plays and your superstar's got 15 minutes, 16 minutes of ice time or something because there just aren't the even strength minutes. So it's like you were saying, it's another way to get these guys on the ice and make sure they get their minutes and, you know, the dollars they're paying these kids, they got to get them out there.
Well, it's as much the dollars as it is to keep them in the flow of the game. We all know that, you know, the offensive players need to play regularly. They're not fourth-line guys who only get their 5 or 6 shifts a night and are thankful for them. So, yeah.
Well, I was kind of wondering about Ovechkin. I start to wonder if this is a good use of the ice time for a scoring machine. And if you have that much penalty time that you have to kill, would you prefer to use his ice minutes on offense where he's more useful? I mean, at least that's how I've been kind of viewing him maybe this is kind of a little bit outdated from this season now, looking at last season and how he was playing on defense.
Yeah, you know, Ovechkin's is a special case. This guy has endless energy, literally. I mean, he'll skate 2-minute shifts and go on 2-on-1 breaks at the end of them like he just hopped over the boards. He's an absolute machine. My concern with him on the penalty kill is when you get a guy like him out top who isn't used to the penalty killing as much, doesn't necessarily know the techniques for, say, shot blocking. You know, you get a defenseman winding up and he turns his, and Ovechkin, you know, turns the wrong way or doesn't block in the, with the proper technique and you bust a foot or something, and there goes your best player for a few weeks. And
I'd be concerned about that myself, yeah.
Yeah, that's something no one, I mean, they certainly can't afford that. So that's really my concern there. I don't know how they address that. But that would be my main concern. I don't really worry about him being fresh for even strength or power play shifts because, I mean, he is always fresh, period. And when he's not, you know, they've got a second line with Alex Semin out there and, you know, give that line a go for 45 seconds while Alex catches his breath or something. So I'm not worried about giving him those minutes there.
Well, taking a look at tonight's game and the lines, they were certainly mixing things up a bit.
Yeah, a bit towards the end. They lost Kozlov, I think, in the first period.
Yeah, it was
second period. I don't know.
First period.
And that forced them to juggle things. I mean, Kozlov, Backstrom, and Ovechkin have been together almost exclusively since Boudreaux came up from Hershey last Thanksgiving. And with the exception, they got broken up a little bit in the playoffs when nothing was working and they had to juggle a bit. And with Nylander moving up to the second line and Fedorov moving back to defense, that changed things around a little bit too. But, you know, you just look at the depth of scoring on this team. this is now two out of three games the Cats have scored four or five goals without Ovechkin getting a point in either of those two games. You know, each game they've had at least four goals, but against Atlanta they had four and Ovechkin didn't have a point, and tonight they had five and Ovechkin didn't have a point, if I'm not mistaken, and no, he didn't. So, you know, the depth of scoring is just impressive on this squad.
Well, yeah, when you're – and it is one of those things where he's the guy that everyone is going to game plan the defense around stopping. And if he's doing his job in soaking up those minutes that way, then any team that doesn't have any defensive depth is going to get hammered by the second and third lines. And he's doing his job even if he's not getting on the score sheet.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly right. So far, Alex Semin's probably been the team's best forward, without question, this season. He's got three goals now, a couple assists, maybe three assists. And, you know, I've gotten hammered writing in the past that I think that Semin might have more of just raw skill than Ovechkin in terms of the things he can do with a puck. But, you know, I stand by it. You know, Ovechkin would rather run over you or run through you, but Semin can dance around you. Like, I mean, the way he dangles a puck, it's like it's very few guys play at that skill level. And then, you know, even when you start with Michael Nylander on your third line and Chris Clark on your third line, who scored 30 goals 2 years ago, you know, the depth is there.
Now, the question is, now, I didn't look at the cap situation before we got on the phone with you tonight. Is there room to put in, to bring in a defenseman, or are you going to have to make a...
No, I mean, that's...
That's the issue.
That's really the problem. Well, you know, maybe it's a problem, maybe it's not a problem, but Carl Alsner, by all accounts, you know, the guy the Caps took fifth overall 2 years ago in draft,
right.
Superstar to be, you know, blah, blah, blah. He probably should have made this team out of camp, but they couldn't take on his salary. Now the coaches will say they want him to get some AHL seasoning. That's what they did with Jeff Schultz. That's what they did with Mike Green, and it helped, and it undoubtedly did with those guys. But I think, you know, if they weren't as close to the salary cap as they are, I think Alsner would have broken camp with the team, and, you know, they wouldn't be in a situation where they are putting Sergei Fedorov back on defense because they can't play John Erskine.
Which didn't look too bad tonight. Sergei Fedorov seemed to kind of relish in the position.
No, Fedorov looked awesome tonight.
Yeah.
He raised the game of Urchina, who's his partner out there tonight, considerably. I mean, other than a bad penalty that Urchina took, I thought Urchina had a very strong game. And, you know, that pairing looked good, but, you know, I don't know if that's an ideal long-term solution back on the blue line, because then you're giving up some of your depth at center, which is really one of this team's strengths. If you have Backstrom, Fedorov, and Nylander down the middle, and then you have Steckel as a checking line center and Boyd Gordon as an alternate checking line center or wing, I mean, the depth at center there is just is very impressive.
Right. Well, every day that the season goes on, your cap position gets a little bit better on a prorated basis. So, you know, as you get later in the season, if you know, they're banking dollars right now, basically, if they need to bring Alsner up, we're in a similar position, not cap-wise, but we're looking at similar things with, like, Mike Weber and Chris Butler over in Buffalo.
Right.
If, you know, if someone's having a bad season, if Jaroslav Spacek is going to be, you know, breaks down halfway through the year, we can you know, package him up and ship him out and bring Weber in. And the same thing with here. I think you're almost going to look at it. McPhee is almost hoping get Alsner half a season down in Hershey and then bring him up when there's enough money to take care of him, dump somebody else, and have just enough cap salary cap to, like, ride through the rest of the season.
I think that's definitely right. I mean, I think I wrote the other day, I'm sure George McPhee is just sitting there counting down the minutes and counting up the dollars until he can bring Alzner back.
Right.
And they're also in a position right now where they should be a good enough team to survive, you know, without having to bring him up right now. So
you got 24. You got 24 games in the Southeast Division. There's plenty of points there to mine. With only four defensemen.
As long as they take everyone seriously, unlike they probably did on Friday night against Atlanta.
You've been listening to The Rink. Our thanks go to our guest, John Press. You can find his work at japersrink.blogspot.com and at nhl.fanhouse.com, where you can also find Tom's writing. My blog is at jerseysandhockeylove.com, and The Rink is located at www.rinkpodcast.com. You can send us an email at rink@rinkpodcast.com or call us at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. And if you want to hear more about the Capitals or John's blogging, you can come back to The Rink for episode 3.5, where we continue our talk with John. Thanks for listening to The Rink.